Today's show is being brought to you by Bob's Red Mill, believers in good food for all. Learn more at bobsredmill.com/podcast.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Cooking Issues. This is Dave Arnold, your host of Cooking Issues, coming to you live on the Heritage Radio Network every Tuesday from roughly 12 to roughly 12:45 from Roberta's Pizzeria in Bushwick, Brooklyn. Joined as usual with Nastasia the Hammer Lopez. How you doing, Stas?
Good.
We got Dave in the booth. Dave?
What up?
Today we got special guest plus entourage, Richard Blaze.
I like the soft golf clap.
Yeah,
that's usually the applause level that I get. I also thought I was going to be like the dynamic one, but that open is just
That's all I got. It's
amazing.
It's like literally like I could come in here off of a bike or like, you know, you could Nastasia could wake me up from a sleep and
on.
Yeah, my kids make me do it every once in a while.
You crushed it. Like, I don't know if I can even, like, go on from that point.
Well, like I say, from here all, it's all, you know, as Trump would say, low energy Dave from here on. Okay.
That was my trombone, by the way.
Yeah, nice.
No, okay.
You played beautifully.
Thank you.
You got to go bass trombone. The bass trombone is not a used enough instrument.
It's not. You know, I'm more of a banjo ukulele guy, though.
Really?
We're getting right into, like...
I tried to learn banjo once, failed miserably.
Yeah, I never could figure it out. And I hear the ukulele is really where you need to go if you're learning a stringed instrument.
I mean, because it's just
got one last string, I guess.
And it's tuned to an open chord.
Right.
So you can just... I mean, that's why Tiny Tim, not a musical genius, was able to cut some popular records... You know, on the ukulele.
This is true.
You know, there is a ukulele resurgence. Every couple of years or every couple of decades, I guess at this point in my life, I feel there's a ukulele resurgence.
Yeah.
You know?
Maybe that I fell into that. Maybe that it was right. Like I just felt it in the air. And
I remember as a small child, I remember Tiny Tim, you know,
the crazy.
You know, Anastasia's probably caught him just wrong. Doesn't remember him
Not at all.
just wrong. Got married on Johnny Carson, I believe.
Oh, really?
I think so.
Oh.
I don't think it lasted.
I thought he was a wrestler.
No.
It would be a good name for a wrestler if he was massive.
Yeah. What do you think about bagpipes? I'm trying to learn the bagpipes.
I can't believe you just said that because I was going to ask you, bagpipes or didgeridoo?
Oh, bagpipes. Bagpipes. Here's why. Bagpipes are not the kind of instrument that you ever want to hear recorded. It, like, needs to be live. It is a martial instrument. It's meant to, like... scramble eggs the inside of your body. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's portable, loud as hell, you know.
Sometimes, just for inspiration, if I'm on a long run, I will cue up, like, the Scottish March.
Really? Yeah, I cue up Long Way to the Top if you want to rock and roll.
It's like Braveheart, you know? For me, it's just...
Braveheart was a good movie.
I don't remember much of it, but I remember I felt inspired by it.
So have we ever said this on air, Anastasia? Like, I always thought it was like a missed... So the end of Braveheart, Mel Gibson is Wallace, right? Mm-hmm. And so at the end of it, you know, he's not like a noble person. He's like a knight, whatever, relatively commoner. He's being executed at the end because he's given up, right? And so at the end... they're cutting his nuts off. And right before they cut his nuts off, he goes, "Freedom!" Like that. And I always thought, what a great, like, ad campaign they could have done if he had just said anything else. Pepsi! That is the last thing. There you go. Wow.
Well done.
Wow. See? The memory. I haven't seen this since it came out. But there you go. So who else we got in the room? Who'd you bring with you? Let's say hello to the entourage in case I pepper them with questions or ask them what they like to eat.
Oh, okay. I'll go around the room. So, Meredith Sidman. Publicist extraordinaire.
Yeah. And in relation to Josh Sidman from Westchester, New York?
No, but I'm from Westchester.
Mm-hmm. All right. Nice.
All right. Leah, publicist extraordinaire.
Yeah. So this is like big flack attack we got going on.
I'm rolling deep because it's Brooklyn, and I felt like to kind of up my street cred, I needed to come in with a big crew.
Got to roll heavy.
And then we just met.
Joyce.
Hi. Joyce.
Hello.
Nice. So
also extraordinaire. I mean, we should not leave that out. Right. I just want to make sure. Everyone's extraordinary.
He just doesn't think so much of you, Joyce. That's the issue. So the reason that you're over here in our fine area in Brooklyn is you got a new book coming out in, like, is it this month or next month?
It's today.
No way. Today. This is the launch?
Yeah, like, this is my first appearance.
No, I mean, I thought you were on the Today Show.
Okay, I was on the Today Show. This is my first audio. What a letdown, first audio appearance.
First audio appearance? How was the Today Show? How was that like?
It was amazing. You know, a couple of years ago, I spilled liquid nitrogen on Kathy Lee's feet and was banned from the Today Show for 3 years.
Really?
So
yeah, she's today she was, can get kind of...
They were amazing, though. They had some Pinot Grigio working, and we did this little snap pea salad.
Yeah? Oh, she likes snap peas. She likes Pinot Grigio. You know she likes the Pinot Grigio.
It was amazing. She had it. I mean, they were both stunning.
Yeah?
Yeah. It was actually a really good segment. I
did that show once on Halloween right after Hurricane Sandy, and I was just – I mean, everyone in New York was just so pissed off. They were like, that guy's never coming back to this show, right?
Right.
And Nastasia has been waiting for years because she, like, literally, like loves holding Kathy Lee.
Love them.
Love.
I love them, too.
I'm an old school Regis and Kathy Lee guy back in the day.
I love Regis. So my first segment I ever did with Regis, right? We're doing the segment where outside. It's outside summer grilling with Regis, right? And he, first time we ever met, many years ago. And he's like, all right, so I'm here with Jeff, and we're cooking. And he keeps calling me Jeff, but in my head, because I have an ego, I'm like, he's calling me Chef. Just go with it. And then, like, all the way through about seven times at the end, he's like, and that was Jeff cooking up some amazing burgers. We'll see you in a minute. But it's Regis Philbin. So that's okay. He can call me whatever he wants.
Whatever in the hell he wants.
Exactly.
Whatever in the hell he wants. Yeah, Regis, good old days. I used to watch all of the daytime TV, like, when I first got out of college. So they were on back then in the early 90s, and I would do only these three things. I would watch daytime TV, I would Bondo my Pontiac, and I would deep fry peppers in my little deep fryer. And that was it. Those are the only three things I did before my job started.
That's amazing.
Yeah. My future wife was like, what the hell are you doing? Why am I with you? What is your problem? She had a real job.
They were great peppers.
They were great peppers.
Let's be honest.
And the Pontiac was pretty sweet for a couple of years.
Yeah.
Definitely the cheapest car I ever bought.
Yeah. And now it's Seacrest, by the way.
What do you mean?
Now Ryan Seacrest? It's Kelly and Seacrest.
Really?
I don't think it's called Kelly and Seacrest. It's Kelly and Ryan.
So did she have a fight with what's his name?
Something happened with Michael, right? Strahan. And then like all it was a big – then they, you know, it's a big reality show of who's going to get it. I thought it was going to be me.
Were you in the running? Were you really?
No, I was not. Oh. No. In my mind, I was in the running.
Have you been on their show?
I have.
Was their chemistry okay?
I thought the chemistry was great. They're amazing too, of course. Yeah.
So something happened.
Something happened. Who knows? But now it's Ryan Seacrest.
All right. Yeah. So let's talk about your book for a minute. And by the way, call in all of your, as I say, call all of your Blaze related questions in to 718-497-2128. That's 718-497-2128. So this book is called So Good. And it's 100 recipes. Is it exactly 100 recipes? I did not count.
You know what? This book was interesting because it was like we were really serious about the 100 recipes. Like it was a metric that I had to hit. So like my publisher's here with me, so I have to, you know. But it had to be 100 recipes. And I was like, do sauces count? Do condiments count? Whatever. No.
Really?
No. So it's probably over 100 recipes.
Don't tell that to Peterson with his sauce book. The sauces don't count. That whole cookbook is sauces.
It wouldn't even be a book. You couldn't even say there were any recipes.
And that's one of the classic books. I love
that book.
Oh, but
then it would be a book with no recipes, and that would be a really good marketing angle.
Really? Do people want to buy books with no recipes?
Probably not.
All right. Well, probably not. Right. So now, I read the introduction as well, and so the conceit here is that people can actually cook this stuff. I mean, the people who listen to this probably are better off, but you include, and I had this same issue when I did my cocktail book. You include a lot of stuff that the average, like, Jane and Joe person wouldn't necessarily, but you always give a way out.
I have to. You have to get – see, I know where you're going with this, right? So it's like the 1% Richard Blaze fans, who, by the way, are known as Blasians, just so we can get that out. Blasians, fans of Richard Blaze.
That's like a Star
There's other
Trek.
Definitions,
That's
but
like a
it's
– Star Trek thing. I
it's like
that.
The third – you know, there's three definitions for it. Right. Like, it's the third one, Blasians.
Nice.
You know, some of them want to see – they want to see the Searsol. They want to see some liquid nitrogen.
Yeah.
You got to give it to them.
I'm for it. Like, here's the thing. It's like, I'm a believer in, you know, if this is the way you actually do it and you're a real live human being, right?
Yeah.
Then just do it that way. And then tell people, look, I don't expect you to do it. And if you were at somebody else's house and you had to cook something, you wouldn't be like, there's no liquid nitrogen. I'm freaking out of here.
Exactly. You know what I mean? Exactly. Right. Yeah. So there should be some, like, it is. So every once in a while, there's a tank of liquid nitrogen in my basement. When I say every once in a while, I mean all the time.
Yeah. Where do you live? Where do you live?
I live a little north of San Diego, Del Mar, California.
Right. Yeah. I'm going to be in San Diego pretty soon. I'm going to stop by the restaurant.
Oh, my gosh. I mean, my staff would freak out if you showed up.
Yeah, I'll be there. I have to do some sort of like thing for a liquor company.
You're mythical to my staff. Like this, you know how much street, how much like cred I'm going to get in my kitchen because I'm on the show?
This guy is good at, this guy's,
Buttering. I mean, buttering it up coast to coast, both sides, but I'm also being honest.
Oh, well, yeah. I appreciate it. So one thing I want to talk to you about, and I noticed in this, and, it's something I think it doesn't get talked to, and this, before we talk about the book in general or any questions, you ever notice how chefs tend to find an ingredient that they fold into their pantry and it shows up as a highlight a lot? I do this all the time and it changes for me every couple of years. I change like what that highlight is. So I remember Nils Noren when I was at the FCI, Akavit and the FCI. For a while, it was like, what does this need? And we were all like, ketchup manisse. Ketchup manisse. That's what this needs. Ketchup manisse.
Yes.
And then
yes.
But there's always, but I noticed, and it's something I actually also love and use a lot. You love the Calabrian chili oil.
I do love the Calabrian chili oil.
Yeah.
But with a lot of these things, isn't it like the moment you had or like the first moment that you had with that ingredient?
Yeah. And you're like, oh, and then so, well, full disclosure, a friend of mine's Calabrian, and whenever he goes over there, they bring back some of their family stock, and he's like, "This time it's not as good as last time."
Right.
But you know what I mean? Yeah. But I have learned to love it. Yeah, and the great thing with ingredients like that is, you associate them with like a particular place, a particular thing, but you get addicted to the certain kind of note, especially something like that. So the way you describe it is a fruity heat.
Right,
but not sweet, but fruity heat. So it's like as an alternative to like the classic thing that most of the chefs have been doing for the past 5-6 years, just hit it with sriracha, not panache, but the hot cock brand of sriracha.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But it's a more neutral and doesn't have the oils. How do you get in? How did you get into the Calabrian chili oil? How long have you been into the
chili oil? I think honestly, and this is, I just stumbled upon a jar of it, and it was it probably was Top Chef or something like that, where on these shows, you get to carry like 10 secret ingredients that are always in your case. And chili oil was always one of mine. A bottle of ghee was always one of mine. Some fish, things that are like special to you that provide something that something's going to need in a 48 episode competition. Sometime I'm going to need something that brings some heat to the game, acidity to the game, some salt, umami, whatever it is. So that's how I found it. And then it was just like, oh, I kind of also just like it in my fridge to like, drizzle over like ranch dressing, because I'm also like, I like ranch dressing.
Who doesn't?
I'm just going to admit that right here.
Who doesn't?
That's like we're at Roberta's, so I feel embarrassed a little bit.
No, my son Dax, that's the first thing he learned how to make. He didn't want to learn to make anything else. Although, he did make for Jen, my wife, he made breakfast in bed first time ever.
That's so nice.
I'm like, you're 12 years old, about time.
What did he make?
French toast, classic, like first thing. And so I'm sitting there in bed. And I'm like, first of all, I would never tell him this. And I don't think he was like, I prefer to eat at a table. That's me. But like, whatever. But my wife was floored. She loved it.
Yeah.
Amazing. He did a great job. But having done this when I was a kid, I was like, what does the kitchen look like?
Of course. Right. Yeah, and it was a disaster, I'm assuming.
Not as bad as I thought.
Nice. I agree with you with the eating in bed sort of thing. Unless you're at a hotel. Then, who cares about the sheets?
Not my bed.
Like, my favorite thing to do is a hotel chicken wings. Two waters. And then, bathroom towel to wipe down afterwards.
You just massage it into the
sheets.
That's
a secret fact. Like, I'm revealing to you. We've connected.
Nice. Well, let me talk to you about the chicken recipe. Let's just go to it.
Okay.
I do that, I noticed also,
we're just having a lot of fun. Don't worry about the book. We're just kicking it.
Here's something I do with people's books. Whenever I get someone's book, right? First thing you got to read someone's introduction to see where they're coming from, where that particular book is coming from, get a feel for where they want to go, right? You agree?
Sure, yeah.
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 Then look at a couple of pictures they choose that have nothing to do with a particular recipe to kind of see where their head's at. And so the one that I gravitated to is the picture of I assume that whoever you were photographing was like, that one, but, cake tester, love it, the cake tester. You got the cake tester, which is like super, I like how was he reading glasses?
Yeah, those are actually my glasses. Like, that's not even just a prop, chef. That's those are my glasses.
What about, like, you can't use that one very often.
No, you know what it is? I'm obsessed with this sort of what's in my purse sort of stuff.
Right, right.
So it's just like, just throw it out there and take a picture of it. And then people are like, oh, wow. He rolls with a cake tester and a pasta cutter.
The cake tester is like, that's the mark of, okay. You got the cake tester. Because that's how I test chicken.
Yeah.
Is that how you test chicken? Yeah, anything like that. In, boop, boop. But I feel like, is that still going strong? Or is that just, like, we're showing our age or what?
We're showing our age probably a little bit, but no, I kind of like it though, right? It's kind of one of those like putting the cake tester in. What is that little pin, chef? What do you have?
Yeah,
but this is how we did it. Do you back in the old days, 10 years ago?
Right. I mean, like here's the other thing too is like a lot of people when they're writing stuff, they're like, oh, stick a thermometer in it. Would you ever stick a thermometer in something?
Well, I will say that I'm doing a couple projects right now. That I'm, and this sort of like, you know this already because you're amazing, right? But like precision is an interesting thing. So like thermometers, I mean, I sous vide things all the time, right? So that's a very precise way to measure something.
Right, right. So yes, exactly. But I rely on it and like my knowledge as a
cook. You don't need the cake tester is what you're saying.
Well, no. Yeah. Cake tester I use.
Okay.
So like when I'm deep frying or something like that, the cake tester I use, but I would never shove an instant read into my piece of chicken.
Yeah.
Because
then the juices get all
my lip and the cake tester are good enough for me.
Yeah, and I do like when you're a good cook and you can just touch something.
Yeah,
you
know,
Or when you ask a chef, well, when is it done? When it's done.
Yeah,
like my favorite answer ever, right? Is like,
but everyone,
when is it finished? When
everyone
it is.
Says you can't know, but that's not true. You can know. You can know.
Yes.
Like even like something stupid like pancakes, right? If your flame is a little off, you touch the top of the pancake and you're like, is that pancake raw in the center or not?
Right.
And you're just like,
yeah.
Is the French fry done?
So much of it is observational, right?
Yeah.
We're dorks also.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm pretty sure.
And what else here? Like you got the Kuhn Recon. That's the peeler to get. Although my wife bought me a Pokemon peeler once that I still like.
Yeah, I mean, listen, I also like it because it's like 49 cents, right?
Yeah,
or probably $1.49 now. But I remember there was also something like, oh, it's the best peeler and it's also like not that expensive.
Right. They get stolen all the time.
Can get one now that's a glove with like a safety mechanism, right? I mean, I'm assuming.
Yeah,
I think
I
so. You don't go to those type of shops.
No. You know what? I used to shop all the time. They used to have a really inexpensive store called Lecter's where you could go just to buy beater stuff. And then they went out of business. And so now either you're going to a department store in New York, you're going to a department store or you have to go high end. And a lot of times... Or a restaurant. A lot of times, like, there's no middle zone. There's not a middle zone. You know what I mean? I don't know.
Maybe. Antique shops. Those are always fun.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
No, but, like, you know, I found some really good, like, old Sabatier knives there. That's all good.
I have a massive Sabatier knife that in culinary school I had to kill a turtle with.
Ooh.
It's a really, like, dark story.
So what kind of turtle?
So I was at the CIA, right, culinary school, just so everyone's clear. And I was the Fish Kitchen Fellowship, which is very prestigious, just so we're all clear. Like, they give away one of those a year.
One, right? And how many students you got? You got a lot of students.
75 students every 3 weeks. So, like, I lived in this fish kitchen, basically. And at some point, someone brought in a giant turtle. Like, someone out in the Hudson River brought in a turtle. And they were like, we need the Fish Kitchen Fellowship guy to come down here. I didn't even have a name at that point. I was just the Fish Kitchen guy. And then they were like, you got to cut this turtle's head off. And it was kind of like, it's kind of a dark story. I'm kind of sad about it.
Well,
I was just doing my job, just to be clear.
Yeah.
And like,
murderer.
Turtle murderer.
You know, people are very uptight about turtles. You know that people are very uptight about turtles, right?
I am too, but for a different reason. You know why? Quick little sidebar here.
All right.
My book, So Good, is being outperformed by the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle pizza cookbook.
So you're for killing them.
Right now I have a little issue with them. One, because I don't think the Ninja Turtles wrote their own recipes. I'm sure of it. Second of all, I'm not a big fan of them as superheroes. Like, I'd take the X-Men. I'd take any superhero group against the Ninja Turtles any day. So after here, I'm going to Times Square. I'm going to take down a couple Ninja Turtles.
Yeah, also, the other thing about it is not really teenagers anymore. I mean, that's the 80s.
No, they don't get –
They're our age.
They never age.
That's not right. Yeah. See, teenager like is an Simpsons. Age. They should just say immature Ninja Turtles.
Yeah. Well
– Mutant. Immature Mutant Ninja Turtles. Because an age is a thing. You don't get to, like, stay a teenager forever. You can act like a freaking teenager forever, but you can't actually be one forever. This is an absurdity.
Yeah.
It makes no sense.
Write your own recipes, Donatello.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I was never a fan, so I don't even know which one's which. I mean, Do they? What are they? They like anchovies.
My girls actually like them. So that's the other thing. Like they like the turtles better than me. And
the old school turtles or these new weird like roided out turtles.
They probably only know the new roided out turtles. It's sad.
It's garbage.
But anyway, yeah, the knife and the turtle and everyone's upset now. But it was a long time ago, and I was just doing my job.
Okay, so apparently, if a turtle goes into its shell, there's a couple of ways you can get the head out.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Stick to lure it out, or the finger the other way. Which would you need to do?
I didn't know about the finger technique, so I'm glad I showed up today. I'll use that in the future.
The head pops out. Yeah. Bang.
So it was a broomstick handle. Yeah.
Yeah, and it bit on it, and you chopped it off?
Yeah.
Strong.
Yeah, this is a disgusting story. I'm sorry. And then, so, like, you do it. Like, it's part of my fellowship, so I'm learning how to butcher this turtle. And, like, that's my, like, I'm learning as a chef.
Which is weird, because not a fish.
Not a fish.
Not a fish.
But who are you going to call? The meat? Yeah. I mean, I guess you could have called the meat butcher.
Right. Well, that's why, like, rabbits are handled by the poultry person, which you said tastes like chicken in the book. I noticed that. But, like, not a poultry.
Sure.
Rodent. Not a poultry.
No, right. Exactly.
You know what I mean?
The scary thing was that turtle haunted me for like days because in the walk-in it was still moving for days after. It was just
They're slow metabolism. They just don't. Yeah, they don't. I mean, it doesn't know it's dead yet. The feet don't know it's dead yet.
Every publicist in this room is freaking out right now. We should just be really
okay.
Clear.
Hold
like,
up.
This has gone to a dark place.
Let me mention something to all of you PR folks.
Yeah, exactly.
And anyone out there in listening land. Almost every piece of meat you've ever eaten, I'd venture to say every piece of meat that you've ever eaten, was at one point an animal.
Yes,
that's
true.
And turtles, while you might like them, while you should not take turtles that are improperly taken from the wild because they take a long time to replenish and you can crash supplies, and so you should not take wild-caught turtles unless you, I guess, are allowed to in a specific place, all of this is true. And I think they're cool. They are not smart. They are not the smartest of animals. Here's here's something that I judge. So if you eat beef, you shouldn't worry about killing a turtle. Turtles don't have now there's some argument about this. One of the things I take is, does an animal have a sense of play? Literally, sense of play. Can it play, right? Does it do things other than avoid things that it hates and get food and sleep, right? Turtles pretty much no play.
Yeah.
No play. There are the birds, obviously, there are other reptiles that can play. Monitor lizards are in the reptile family, like can get to that level where they have those kind of interactions. But if you don't have a sense of play, pretty much I don't feel that bad about it.
Yeah. So that is your note to the publicists in the room, correct?
Yeah.
Okay.
So. Yeah. Yeah, but the thing is, the people nowadays, they get so hyped up about, no one wants to, it's because we're so separated from the food that we eat.
You're right. Yeah.
You know, how'd it taste?
We made like a traditional, turtle soup with sherry and,
Yeah.
Was it worth it? I mean, I just did my job. I'm a student. I was a student. I want to be clear.
Very rarely, with the exception of fish and crustaceans, like the work of killing something makes the food to me not as much fun. I don't know something about it. Me personally.
But it does give you the gravity. Every cook does need to know all the things you said. Like, hey, this thing was alive, and you need to respect it, and you need to eat it, and you need to use all of it, right? But like, I don't. Yeah, like frogs. Do you like frogs?
No.
I'm not a big fan of frogs.
No.
But there was a point in my career I was like, ooh, we got to do a frog dish.
Yeah.
We got these frogs.
I really don't like the way that they're killed where you buy them. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, but again, no sense of play. Shouldn't worry about it too much. But it's still just bad form. You know the way they kill frogs, right?
Yeah. Tell it, Dave.
I don't, so I'm just,
well,
by
so
the way.
So if you go to, at least this is in New York City. If you go to a New York City Chinatown to buy frogs, which is where you get them here, there's a trash barrel full of live frogs where they're just basically crushing themselves. And, we're talking about, how big is that size? Like 3.5 inches?
Sure.
Four, somebody about that size.
Yeah.
And the guy, assuming it's a guy, I've only ever had guys. I don't want to, could be anyone, right? Grabs the frog's rear legs, goes, boop, sticks the, like lays the frog out, bap, onto the cutting thing, bap, bap, with the cleaver, takes the two legs off, put the legs in the plastic bag. I think they weigh them first because you pay on whole frog weight.
Right.
Then they take the live, rear legless body and throw it into the trash heap along with the fish guts. Because a frog's a fish. Did you know that? You knew that.
Right.
Frog's a fish.
This is amazing, though, but I've never seen the barrel and the butchery of...
Bap, bap. Bap, 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 bap. Yep, because why would you take home that whole frog body that you're about to throw away when all you want is that rear leg? You know, that's the theory of it.
Thank you for making this day worth it to me educationally as well.
We have just alienated all of your by the way, you have a podcast coming, speaking of listeners, right?
Yeah, so no one even knows. This is a world premiere. So nice. I am getting into the podcast game, and now I know that I also have to work on my open, by the way. Like, thank you for just like, whoa, that's like how my open, because you're always worried talking about food on radio or an audio that it's not gonna have any energy, right?
Right, right.
But like, oh my God, like now I have a goal, like to get to that Dave Arnold energy.
Punch into it.
So yeah, the podcast is gonna be out soon, and it's called Richard Blaze is Starving for Attention, which is perfect for me.
Nice. So what's other than food, what's the subject? Like
we're gonna talk to everyone in the industry. I mean, obviously chefs, restaurateurs, and people in the beverage community, but also with really getting into media and television and you know, people that create food television shows, how it is to produce something, create a television show, and get into the media side
and,
of it.
And Nightmare, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So what do you think, though? Now that you've been doing it so long, what do you think about it? Like, here's my thing. Without, for instance, the Food Network, I mean, there wouldn't be, I mean, like, come on. I mean, the amount of interest and that is generated, like, countrywide, worldwide, like, the food media has done a lot for food writ large that I think it doesn't necessarily get credit for.
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, you have to say it's been great because it's inspired so many people to discover things that they've never known that they would be into. The only sidebar is that, you know, because food is all over the place, that, you know, when as a restaurateur and as a restaurant chef, you know, you do get, you know, kids that come in that want to be a celebrity chef.
Right.
They've never been in the kitchen before. It, you know, it took me 12 years before, you know, I luckily got asked to come on a TV show or something like that. So you get a lot of that. Like, oh, I want to do cookbooks and be on TV shows. And you can do that. But, you know, it's not what we necessarily need in the restaurant.
Right. I mean, that pisses off all of my New York buddies. It pisses them all off. But on the other hand, like, you're griping about something. And yet, on the other hand, you're a well-known chef because there is food media. So it's like they get mad about these, like, young kids coming in and wanting to be all hot shots. And you can't have your cake, to use another food reference, and eat it as well. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because you can either own your cake or you can have eaten your cake. This is the only two choices. You know what I mean? Like, you can't expect to be a well-known chef that people write about and then get pissed off that somebody else wants fame and doesn't necessarily understand the work that's involved.
Yeah, and if you microwave that cake.
Yeah, super fast.
Yeah, then there you go. And then people are interested in your cake.
Pretty much everybody knows that the solution to this problem is to make two cakes. You make two cakes, one that you keep for visuals, that's the one that's iced well, and one that has a better icing to cake ratio that you eat that tastes better. I mean, that's the answer.
Yeah, yeah. Well, with almost anything, too. I mean, that's interesting. Like, how do you cook on television, which is another thing that I really love talking about, is like, you do things like that. You make two of the dish that you're about to serve so you can test one, so you can pick which one's a little bit better than the other one. Yeah.
So when you're doing TV, how much prep time do you have? In other words, so here's the issue I see a lot of people, especially young people starting out, especially if they want to do kind of new technique stuff, they do stuff that they haven't necessarily tried, and it can be nerve-wracking, right? Trying something for the first time on the camera.
Oh, I mean, that's the biggest mistake, right? For all these young kids on shows like Chopped or Top Chef or something like that, then they're making blueberry snow out of maltodextrin, and it's really not delicious. And everyone's kind of also seen it by this point. And then they get sent home, and then they're like, oh, the judge doesn't get me. No, they get you. They get you really well. You thought that, you know, that was some secret thing you just pulled out, and it didn't taste good.
Right. I mean, the thing is that, like, I think to me it's okay to try some combination you've never tried before, but make sure that if you're going to serve people, that the technique you're going to use is something that is in your toolkit, that's in your – you understand how it works. You understand why you're using it,
yeah,
right?
And it has to serve deliciousness. I mean, it's pretty simple. So if you can do both, then you're, you know, you're going to be famous like Richard Blaze. I mean, that's obvious.
Oh, we got a caller. Let's see what they got. Call? Caller, you're on the air.
Hey, everyone. This is Anton from Pennsylvania. I'm a research chemist in training, and I've been following cooking issues for some time now.
Where in Pennsylvania?
In college.
Where in Pennsylvania?
I'm in Allentown, but I commute all the way from Philadelphia.
All right, nice. All right.
I was just in Allentown.
Yeah, I used to have relatives who lived there, actually just outside in Kutztown.
Yeah, yeah. Right. My mom lived in Scranton for a bit.
Really? Nice.
We're just connected on so many levels.
Good. And so what do you got? What do you got for us?
Yeah, this is actually my first introduction to Allentown. But I actually wanted to say, before I get to my question, that Alton Brown's Good Eats was my first introduction, like really compelling introduction to science and not just food.
So really?
That's pretty seminal to where I am now. But in regards to my actual question, I've been wanting to experiment with homemade miso, and I wanted to know if store-bought miso, say from Whole Foods, would be appropriate for culturing my substrate. A friend of mine has taken charge of a Korean natural farming program in New Jersey, and we'll be trying to optimize their rice operation, which they claim to be one of the few farms producing rice in the Northeast. All this being said, I wanted to use this opportunity to experiment on some novel rice strain and just kind of play around with miso. So I wanted to know your thoughts.
Real quick, can I just take a real quick?
Yeah.
I'm going to pass on this one. like I thought we were going to the right place with Alton Brown, and then like, yeah, this is a Dave Arnold question.
No, well, actually, you know, you should. Our Cook Quest, who is like the miso master, does like a miso workshops. I mean, it depends on what you buy. There are misos out there that haven't been dorked with, and that are still kind of alive. But you can just get koji. I would just buy the koji. It's readily available, and you know, look up tweet Our Cook Quest. That's his Twitter, I think, right? Our Cook Quest. Yeah. He's been on the show before, actually, and he can hook you up with like the very best in koji strains. But you know, like here's the issue: when you're doing something like that, I mean, unless you have a miso that you lovely love, and like you're like maybe there's some special mojo about this, I would just use and he is of the opinion, by the way, Rich, that's Our Cook Quest, that the strain of koji isn't necessarily so as important as the substrate. But
right.
So I would just buy the koji. This way you're guaranteed to have it work. It's not already been possibly, you know, treated with something or, you know, because a lot of times, especially, I don't know what misos you're trying to make, but if they're doing like a shiro miso or something like this, they hit it with alcohol to wipe out some of the, you know, a little bit of alcohol to stop it from further, fermenting or breaking down. So I don't know. But I'm interested in this Northeast rice. Have you guys ever heard of this?
Mm.
Northeast rice? Anyone? Northeast rice?
I think it's a novelty. So my friend studied at USC, chemical engineer there, and I guess he ended up working at a commune in Ojai, California, which I don't know if anybody knows Southern California.
I just partied in Ojai like 2 weeks ago.
Really?
It's an amazing place. Yeah.
Nice. All
right. Right. So he learned some Korean natural farming and like worked with indigenous microorganisms. I don't know if any of this like rings a bell, but He brought it over here, and he kind of ended up talking to this farm in Pennington, New Jersey, called Blue Moon Acres, and they were super open to the idea, and it looks like they were kind of heading in the same direction, so the stars kind of aligned, and I've enjoyed their rice. I mean, they're still pretty young in terms of the actual program, but I figured I might as well, like, use this opportunity. Why not?
Yeah. All right. Well, you know, like, let's see. Like, my point is that it depends on what they can grow. So, like, New Jersey, any time that they're not growing a tomato or growing a corn, I want to hit them because, like, that's what they should be doing. But I'm sure there are land types in New Jersey that don't grow great corn and great tomatoes. So then, yeah, grow rice, right? I mean, grow rice, I guess. A lot of great things. You know, New Jersey, Garden State, we forget that New Jersey was the Garden State. And especially, you know, Richard, you're a Long Island guy.
Yeah.
Which we grew up not hating, but, you know, ranking on New Jersey. But
it's like your cousin you give a little, you know, a little hard time to every once in a while, right?
Yeah. It's like, imagine if your cousin was the Jersey Turnpike.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. You'd give him a pretty hard time. Yeah.
Yeah.
But a lot of good things came out of New Jersey, like Welch's Grape Juice. Do you like Welch's Grape Juice?
Love Welch's Grape Juice.
You have a recipe for Concord Grapes in here. Welch's Grape Juice, New Jersey. Vineland.
The best.
Yeah.
Six Flags. We used to go from Long Island to Six Flags.
Okay, here's one for you. For those who, you're too young. Yeah. Remember Action Park in Vernon, New Jersey?
I do.
Yeah, and people, what I didn't realize as a kid, people would die there constantly.
Yeah, I had my junior high class trip there.
Yeah, sick. Yeah,
it was amazing.
Sick, yeah. Yeah, people would apparently get drunk. I was too young. The people who worked there would get drunk and rip the regulators off of the go-karts so that the go-karts had unlimited speed at night, and they would also be drinking. So, like, workers used to die all the time. Now, forget the kids. Workers used to die all the time.
Oh.
Why don't they bring that place back? Why don't they bring it back?
Hey, it's Kathy Irway, the host of Eat Your Words. Today I'm here with Camilla Salisbury, author of Bob's Red Mill Everyday Gluten-Free Cookbook, 281 Delicious Whole Grain Recipes. We're going to get to the bottom of this gluten-free craze. So why aren't people eating gluten, and what does gluten-free really mean?
Well, there are two main reasons why people are deciding to go gluten-free these days. And the first one is really serious. It's for people who have celiac disease, and it's a pretty serious condition. But then there is also a growing number of people with gluten intolerance or gluten sensitivity, and they're trying out gluten-free diets because they find that eating foods without gluten just makes them feel better.
Okay, got it. But what actually makes something gluten-free?
Well, what makes something gluten-free is essentially that it doesn't have any of the protein, gluten, in it. And a lot of people are surprised to learn that many grains do not contain gluten, when in fact just a very small number of grains do.
Does anyone offer truly gluten-free options?
Well, Bob's Red Mill really understands gluten-free options, and that means they separate their grains during the manufacturing process, and so they're testing each batch at every step of the way for purity to ensure that it's gluten-free. So when it says on the package that it's gluten-free, you can be assured that it is gluten-free.
All right, so gluten-free listeners out there craving some steel-cut oats can pick up a pack of Bob's Red Mill and rest assured you're getting the real deal. Learn more about Bob's Red Mill and all the gluten-free products that they offer at bobsredmill.com/podcast.
So anyway, I hope that answers
another
your
call?
Question.
Another call?
Sure, caller, you're on the air.
Hey, Dave. It's David from California.
How you doing? Where in California?
Great. Hey, Richard.
Hey, what's
I
up?
Love Juniper and Ivy out here, by the way.
Oh, thank you.
Hey, so there's a lot of myths surrounding this. Should I salt my eggs before cooking or only after? And what's the science behind why you do one or the other?
Before I have him answer, which style of egg are we talking here?
It could be scrambled, an omelet, almost any style.
Mm. Well, this is ironic because, Dave, I was going to ask you the same question. Like, when I came up here, I was like, what am I going to ask him? I was going to ask you about how do you season your eggs before
yes.
or during or after. Yeah, I season omelets definitely before.
Yeah.
Maybe, like, over easy, maybe, like, just as a finish, but that's how I cook.
Yeah, definitely. Here's some things. It does change the egg somewhat, and I think in a helpful way. So, like, sweet egg preparations, like a sweet omelet, like a tamago or something like this, right? Delicious, right? But you know when you're blending that stuff beforehand, you can see the yolks go kind of translucent on you when you add like the salt and the sugar. And so you're definitely changing the egg yolk by adding that stuff, I think, in a positive way. That's just my feeling. Yeah. And so I do it beforehand.
And it's, yeah, in a positive way, making it more delicious.
That's right. I'm also a firm believer in not having a thing that needs a bunch of salt throughout with some salt on top. I prefer properly seasoned throughout with a little salt on top. You know what
right?
I mean?
Right, like, yeah, yeah. So, but you do, you like finishing salt though, right?
Love it.
Because I think that's one of the things that just happens in restaurants that regular restaurants don't do it. And like it's just whether it's a little drizzle of oil, a little citrus, some zest, little salt, like those little finishing touches. That's why I love the pass. Right?
Yeah, yeah. Because you can look at it and be like, and then you fix it.
It's not just
at the
about
end.
Spitting food out. It's about like the finishing touches.
And putting the eyeballs on. But in a sandwich situation, every freaking layer gets its own salt. Like a little bit. So like when I slice the tomatoes, now you don't want to salt the tomatoes way ahead of time because Christmas gets ruined, destroyed, Christmas over. You're a bad person. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But unless you're making a salsa or something like this, you want to break it down. But like salt the tomato on, and then every layer gets its own thing.
Yeah, with burgers especially. Yeah. That's like one of my pet peeves. Like season the tomato that's on the burger.
Because it wants it.
It wants it.
You make the – yeah, you salt – I don't salt the inside of the burger because I don't want the texture to change. So I salt the ever-loving crap out of the outside of the burger.
We're on the same camp right there. Right. We're vibing right now. Also, there
you, oh, but you have a stuffed burger, which we'll talk about later. But then the – yeah, and then you salt the different layers because they want it. Because yeah. they freaking want it.
Back to eggs real quick. Right. This is something I just did recently. I had a little black truffle on my person, and I brought it on an airplane with me.
That's smelly.
And it is. And when I got served an omelet, which most airlines serve a
little
omelet.
Please tell me you did not do this. How did you get the shaver on board?
I had a little rasp that somehow like got through. And I just was like, you know what? Just for my person sitting next, I was like, I'm gonna give this guy a show. And I pulled out a little black truffle on an airplane and just rasped, just showered this, you know,
vomlet. We call those omelet, things vomlet
with real black truffle. And like it was kind of amazing.
Did it unovercook the omelet?
I mean, it made it kind of like enjoyable in the entertainment value.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. How do you? Those things are.
I was surprised that I even got on the plane with a truffle, not only just the rasp.
If you know what, like I bet you a little oil as well could bring that omelet back from the brink, right? The oil on the truffle would just be like a topping, and then you could think of the omelet as bread.
And if you put some gooey cheese in the omelet, that helps.
That helps too. Sort of, but they don't do that, do they, right?
One of them does. I mean, not to judge airlines on their omelets, but I would say I actually fly Delta all the time, but United has a really good omelet.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah, like, so that's the like, one thing
like
they can
during
do,
during the whole thing with United, I was like, but they make a decent omelet.
The omelets... I told last week, or 2 weeks ago, I talked. They killed a giant rabbit. They ripped that guy off the airplane.
It's hard, yeah.
You know what I mean? Yeah. But their omelets, good.
Pretty good. I mean, as far as airlines go, I got to keep it real. Like, they make a good omelet for an airplane omelet.
What kind of container do they in? Like, and how much of the omelet tears away when you open that foil thing? Is it just some sort of hideous nightmare with that? Like,
no, they, so, you know, I'm riding up front, Dave. Okay. So, like, they're pulling the, at least on this flight, and they're pulling the foil off up front. I don't see it. And it's a nice little container. Listen, you know, I mean, I could leave the sausage and sweet potato hash off to the side, but the omelet is pretty good. You put a lot of the truffle on it.
Yeah. I ride deep coach.
Deep coach. Middle seat coach.
Yeah.
Like the seat right before the back bathroom.
Yeah, well, Nastasia and I are like, does that seat recline? Because if it does, it's too good for him. And like they, you know, right?
That's right.
Deep coach. Cattle class. You know what I mean? Like I'm one step above the rabbit that United killed by putting it in a freezer. They do let me deplane with the rest of the passengers just last. You know what I mean? Oh, man. Oh, airplanes. Eggs, has this helped you at all?
Yes, it does. So you're gonna chalk it up to urban myth that chefs who say salt it less against only.
Well, why would they – what's the theory? What's the theory of operation why I would want to salt it at the end only?
You'd have to ask the chefs who insist on it. I don't know.
Look, here's what I'm going to say about this. Most people that I know – even complete nincompoops who are professional cooks that cook all the time, if you taste their food and their food is good, then you, even if their explanations are crazy and make no sense to you, it makes sense to kind of focus on their technique and what they do and why they do it, and maybe you learn something that you didn't already know, like aside from what you in your head think, right? So the first thing is their food good? And then if it is, just observe what they do, and maybe there's a good reason. I don't know.
And current company excluded, most chefs are just assholes.
Family show.
Oh, sorry.
That's all right. Don't worry about it. You're allowed to. I was looking up. You know, in North Ireland now, not in like lower UK, you're allowed to say gobshite on the TV.
Oh, I just want to start saying that just in general.
It's a good word, right?
I've never said it.
Mouth poop.
Is that what it means?
It translates, like gobstopper, like everlasting gobstopper, like a mouth stopper, the gob being the mouth.
Ooh.
Gobshite, mouth
I should have
poop.
Thrown that one. I apologize, by the way.
Gobshite.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we're not in Northern Ireland, but, you know.
All right. Thanks to both of you.
And tweet us and tell us why I'm not supposed to add the salt until the end. Maybe there's some sort of reason. I don't know. I can't see a reason why I would want the inside of my egg not to taste good.
I'll give him the over easy. Like maybe over easy because it's thin and like you can.
Yeah. Also, by the way, here's an admission. I don't do the French style curded scrambled egg. I don't. I like an American style scramble, like a hard curd, not the creamy curd.
Ooh.
So maybe, but no, all those creamy curd ones are salted, but maybe they're salted towards the end. Maybe it affects the curd structure. maybe that's what the chef is talking about if they're doing the old school French.
But there are a lot of those myths, right, that you just kind of pick up and it's just like, why are you doing it? Oh, because the last 12 people told me to do it this way, but I've never thought about why I'm doing it.
Salt 100% and sugar 100% affect the temperature at which the protein sets and probably also the curd structure. So maybe it has something to do with those French, like, you know what I'm talking about, the super slow.
Is it a moisture issue? Like like salting mushrooms only at the end of a cook time?
Which I salt that stuff right at the beginning.
Look at you.
Yeah. Salt everything right at the beginning. Salt. Salt is your buddy. Speaking of salt, why do all chefs, I like them, why do all chefs love the boquerones more than the salted anchovy?
I like both for different things.
Yeah, they're different.
Yeah, one to eat on its own on a nice tartine, which was a bruschetta, which now is a toast. I can't keep up with what's cool to call a slab of toast. So I like the boquerones for that. But like for a sauce or something, right?
Get
the old school, throw it
old
in
school.
There.
Yeah. I like the tinned, packed in salt guys. They're really good.
Yeah.
And you know, they recently, so for those of you that buy anchovies packed in salt, they used to, for my whole life, they came in a giant, not giant, but like four anchovies, giant can that's like kind of like, it looks like an oversized tuna fish can. You know the one I'm talking about, right? And it's metal, right? And you have to open it, and then it's sitting around in your fridge, unless you use a boat ton of anchovies, and the can can sometimes rot through. They just move to a plastic tub. Huh.
So my God, that's blasphemy.
Yeah. No, you don't like the plastic tub?
I kind of like, I buy those just for the tin because the tin is I love the tin.
You love the tin?
Right?
All right.
I mean, I'll get the plastic tub as well, but I feel like that's a shame.
Try the plastic tub.
That's really a shame,
actually. So here's some random stuff. So I noticed you do your squash blossoms in a masa flour. You like the crispy crunch on the masa? Well, I feel people underuse masa on a fry batter.
Here's the thing. A native New Yorker who lived in Atlanta for many years, and now I live in Southern California, and like my world has been open to all things Mexican, basically. So we pay a little homage to, you know, some traditional Mexican foods at my restaurant in Southern California. And I think that you're looking at a squash blossom relleno.
Yeah, but I like the texture of a masa, fried masa dusting better than cornmeal.
Yeah.
I think.
A little, not quite as grainy, right?
Right, but also it maintains it. You know how when you fry in a cornmeal, it sogs out pretty quickly.
It does.
So masa is hard the way corn is hard. It has the crunch, but I don't think it sogs out as fast.
Right. Masa is also the name of one of my sous chefs who's never soggy.
It is, but
he's always crisp and just on top.
Japanese. Strong. But do you like play off, make masa, cook masa?
No, but you've just inspired that.
That's
so
what's
when we
happen.
Put this dish on the menu.
So a couple other things. I noticed that you like to mess with the names of things to piss off purists. I'm assuming it's to piss off purists. You have a steak tartare recipe in here called carne asada.
Oh, yeah, right. It makes no sense. Right?
Zero sense. Like, anti-sense.
Yeah, and it's raw. It's supposed to be it's cooked. No, it's raw. Yeah, we like to have fun. We make up words. Like, so when we do, when we blend some uni into linguine, we just call it linguine. Because, why not just create a word while you're at it? If you're an artist, create the word, not just the food.
Well, my favorite pun in this is you do Wu-Tang clams.
Wu-Tang clams.
Because it's got the Chinese sausage.
Yeah, but listen, the thing about, because it's got the Chinese sausage, but also Wu-Tang clams, ain't nothing to shuck with.
There you go.
And
you're selling Nastasia. Nastasia loves some puns.
So I'm a 90s hip-hop kid, so I'm a native New Yorker, so we'll never break out of that.
Yeah. So, Nastasia, brace yourself here.
Okay,
there's a Puttanesca in here, right? It's bucatini, but no freaking tomato.
Huh.
It's got capers. It's got olives. Not the right kind for you, but it's got olives in there and capers. No freaking tomato.
Yeah, well, it's a green version of it, right?
Yeah.
So it's a green version. So can you give me, I know when we start talking about Italian food, the authenticity issue gets pretty strong.
Well, it's interesting that you do a green puttanesca. Yeah, especially
everything's green in the book. Is this where we're going?
No. You do that. So then I'm like, all right, he's doing a green puttanesca. Okay, whatever.
Right.
I mean, not puttanesca, but okay. And then I turn the page and I see crab meat and a tagliatelle. I'm like, what is he going to cover this with? And you go breadcrumbs. And I was like, that's right.
That's right, yeah. Well,
breadcrumbs.
We got the Calabrian chilies. We opened with that. And there's some sort of authenticity, Richard Blaise. There's a little bit there.
You got to go breadcrumbs. Yeah. I love breadcrumbs on the pasta, by the way. My son Booker loves it. He puts too much on. He calls it Mount Breaderist. He pours breadcrumbs all up in his pasta. But I love breadcrumbs.
You also
on
have
pasta.
To care for the breadcrumbs, though. This is a pet peeve of mine too. Like, you have to make the breadcrumbs toasty and delicious.
You're better
and
than I am. You're
they have to be
I
seasoned, right? Like, you can't just. I've seen on TV shows, like, you can't just open up panko and pour it on top of your pasta dish, and you're not. You're really not servicing the dish well.
What's that brand that comes in the tub? You know what I'm talking about? The tub of breadcrumbs that's above the bread aisle. What's that stuff? What's that brand?
Don't sleep on 4C. Don't
4C, that's
don't
it.
Don't sleep on my mom's go-to
4C.
4C breadcrumb seasoning. You've never had Long Island chicken cutlets like that, Dave.
Never. Does a Salisbury steak where he remolds the freaking meat back on the bone. First of all, for any of you that grew up with a television, Salisbury steak.
That's my go-to TV dinner.
There
right?
you go.
But here's why. Because you got the Salisbury steak, and then what lives right over the little cliff there is the cherry cobbler. And if you work a little of that cherry cobbler into your demi-glace from the Salisbury steak,
you're all ready to go.
You got cherry demi-glace, basically.
So this is like the most not Swanson's Hungry Man looking Salisbury steak.
That's one of my favorite recipes in the book, because it's a hamburger on a giant bone. Like, that's what hamburgers have been missing.
Do you do this in a restaurant?
We've done it in the restaurant here and there. I would love to put it on the menu, and maybe the book will drive that.
Will Californians pick up a bone like that?
Yes. Yes.
Southern Californians? Like, what about L.A. people? Will L.A. people pick up a bone like that?
Yeah, I think they will. I will say that, you know, the first question in California, you do the menu testing, and you know, does anyone have any questions about the 75 items on this menu? And then the first question is, can you get gluten-free? And, you know, can you do that vegan? Yeah, so, I mean, that's just California.
This would be a very difficult vegan recipe.
That would be that would be really tough. Because how do you make a giant bone out of tofu? I mean, you would have to tackle that.
Yeah,
that requires an advanced mind.
They could have the herbs and the garlic, but that's about it.
Yeah, no, that's it.
You can't get
that one.
Here's one that's going to drive Nastasia insane. Nastasia has a very, like you know, to her fans, well-known vegan face. You ready for it?
Yeah.
I guess it's not vegan. Yeah. Ready? Beet loaf. Not meatloaf. Beet loaf. What do you think about that
one? Who hates beets.
You hate beets.
I hate beets, but you hate
beets. You hate beets?
I don't hate beets. I don't hate... That's a lie. That's a lie. I love beets. What I don't like is when they taste dirty and they're in giant chunks. I like a pickled beet.
Yeah.
I like a sliced beet. I like a beet salad. I like beets in things. I like party hydrated beets.
I'm going to take it to a place where you wouldn't know that I would go there. I like canned beets.
Oof.
Yeah, I like them. They're earthy. I don't like when beets sneak up on you, like later in the day when you maybe are going to the restroom.
Yeah.
And then like you have that one moment where you're like, oh my God. Oh, okay. It's all right. I had beets.
Sneak beets.
I had beets.
Sneak beets. So is this actually, like, honestly though, is
it's cooked
taste
in
good?
The tree. It's delicious.
For real.
Yeah, it's tastier than the picture looks.
Let me see here. So you have a recipe for gumbo, and you're like, gumbo's ugly. I'm just not going to shoot it.
No, listen, you can't shoot all it. Actually, the soup chapter of the book is one of my favorites, because they're all sort of soups that are meals. Like, I know you could do the nice little puree soup with some croutons, but like these are all soups. Like, you put out a big bowl of it, and your family just goes at it. So like... gumbo, congee, some of the recipes we have in there, they're like meals. Borscht, when it's like just lots of chunky things flowing around. I like soups like that.
You know what you put meals. In as one of your seminal like childhood or like, you know, young adult, the Tom Kagai. You know who doesn't like Tom Kagai?
Yeah.
This one over here.
Yeah, I get it. Is it
I don't.
Too
this
much
is delicious.
Fish sauce?
It's the coconut milk, right?
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah. Just forget it. She's just crazy. You know what else she doesn't like? Biscuits.
Wait a second. You don't like beets? Biscuits, or Tom Kagai?
Well, coconut milk, hot coconut milk, do not like.
Do you like cold coconut milk? No.
No.
Okay.
Okay, so you don't, you do not like coconuts.
No. Okay, but hold up. So I noticed in here, and I've seen this a lot in the past couple of years, is that people pushing towards cream in the biscuits. So like mixing the butter base down with some cream. So do you like it because the biscuits just are more tender, because there's a little extra moisture in them?
This recipe is... an homage to a sort of food scientist, Shirley Corer.
I've met her a couple times. She
this recipe, if there's one recipe you're going to do that one.
And you like the self-rising flour. You call for the old school Southern self-rising.
You got the lily white. You got to get the lily white. And, you know, maybe there's a little like sentiment behind it as well. But it's like a cakey biscuit. Like you almost have to serve it in the tin, because you can't like remove it from the tin. That's how soft, creamy, supple it is. Can you say supple for a biscuit?
Supple. Yeah.
Is that a word for food? Like, I hate when people do that, by the way, so I shouldn't...
Are these cut or are these dropped? These biscuits. They're cut, right?
Yeah. Well, you just fill up the pan and just get my Thanksgiving sort of recipe, and we serve it at the restaurant. It's really popular.
Hey, Dave,
it's
we got to wrap it up in a minute.
Okay. So I noticed your cornbread recipe doesn't have enough butter. Kidding.
Does it? Yeah, it's got too much butter?
No, and then no, it's like it's good if it's a lot of butter.
And then when it comes out, put more butter on it. That would be my suggestion.
So just for those of you to know, like it's so we're looking at like a little more. Oh, you do blue. A little more cornmeal than flour, but like you know, pretty close to that kind of classic 1-1, right? So a little over a cup of each. And then 2 sticks of butter to 4 eggs. It's like, boom, man. That's like twice waffle butter, which is nice.
There's plenty of vegetable recipes in the book.
And then a pound of jalapeno butter to serve on the side.
Well, listen, that's, you know, you put some in the fridge. A lot of the recipes in there are, okay, you're going to make this thing, jalapeno butter, this mayonnaise sauce, and then you put it in the fridge because don't you want to have stuff left over?
I do. Yeah. By the way, there's a picture of you, chef, hitting the whipped cream directly out of the EC. I have to tell Dax, my son Dax, every day not to do that.
Yeah. So that's
bad example.
It is a horrible example. I am a horrible example. I hope that I've made that clear.
All right. One more thing. I'm going to have you answer one question, but then your chicken recipe, interesting because it's closer to like what I would see. Like it goes directly from – you do 2 marinades first. You do a pickled marinade, brief pickled marinade, then in buttermilk, presumably to tenderize and soften, right? Yeah. And then directly into the flour mix, which is very – like pies and thighs used to do it that way. I think Robert's used to do it that way. But it's like to me an alternate because I'm a dry, dust, wet thing. And you go right out of the thing. But like it lacquers – and your
right
stuff
into
looks
it, and
lacquered
you let it
almost.
Sort of air dry a little bit if you can. And that sort of I think helps with that.
Did you lacquer
section.
Did you lacquer your chicken? It looks so shiny. Like it looks like
almost
Korean.
Yeah, so that one – that the picture there, then we toss it back in that sort of Nashville – hot sauce, which really works.
Yeah, that's the secret. Yeah. All right, now you're going to answer this question on the way out. Before.
Oh, my gosh. Okay. I'm not prepared for any questions.
Yeah, here it is. Vlad, which is an amazing name. Vlad.
Vlad. I want to change my name now.
Yeah, Vlad. Here it is. I have a question about searing duck breast. Every time I sear and finish it in the oven, it comes out good, but when I start to cut it, juices are everywhere. And when I transfer the cuts to a plate, the juices continue leaking, and it does not look good, especially with mashed potatoes. I know about resting. I tried it too, but the meat cools down very quickly, and after 5 minutes rest, the breasts are not hot enough, and some juices are still running to the plate. So this my current method is to give the breasts a minute or so of rest, and then to cut it and put it on towels to absorb the juices before I plate it, but I'm still losing the juices. What am I missing out on? And Vlad's technique is to... score it, salt, pepper, skin down for until it browns, and then in a hot oven for 7 minutes.
Wow. I mean, my answer is going to be super simple. Maybe it's the bird itself, right? Because depending on what that bird's been fed, there could be all sorts of...
Or do you think, like, if it's frozen, like, it's going to...
Frozen or, yeah, sometimes it's, like, just brined or something. I don't know if the... Probably hasn't been brined.
Yeah, I tend not to too much because I think it firms up the inside it firms up the breast.
I'm thinking about what he's using. Yeah,
oh, yeah, yeah.
But also, you got to let it rest. It seems like it's a resting issue. And then like a little heat lamp sort of. Like if it's resting but in a warm space.
That's what I'm saying. Hot plate. Yeah. Like let it rest. Hot plate. Hot plate. If you're going to do a duck breast like this, right?
Right.
Warm your plates a little bit. Like if you, right, he doesn't have 2 ovens. This is why it's useful to have a plate heater, right?
Right, yeah.
Not to push my own stuff, I sometimes will sears all my plate a little bit to warm it up so that it doesn't cool down your product too much.
By the way, if there ever was like a Game of Thrones, like sort of like, oh, chef, pick your weapon, I grab the sears all.
Especially if someone has it and you fire it right next to their ear, they're like, what?
Yeah, I also like will wrap some like I'm also swinging it.
Oh, nice.
Just so you know, like if you can paint that picture.
My lawyers probably say that you should not do that.
Don't do it at home. No, I'm not suggesting that at all. But
lawyers are saying we got to wrap it up.
All right. So listen. All right, Dave. Jeez, Louise. All right. So Vlad, you know, if you have more questions or if you want more, we'll deal more. I have some other questions about cocktails. I didn't get to them. I apologize. We'll get to you. I might be in China next week, people. So I might not be back next week. I'll let you know via Twitter whether I'm back. We're going to visit because we're doing the Spinzol, which is the centrifuge I'm working on. So I have to go to Shenzhen to pre-approve, and it might be next week.
How much does it hold, like per vial?
It's open bucket. So it's 500 milliliters per bucket, but you can run it continuously, so you can just set it and forget it, walk away from it, and do liters and liters and liters.
Dude.
Working on it. All right, so you heard it here today first. This is other than the Today Show, so I'll take seconds to Hoda and Kathy Lee any day. Richard Blaze's new book, So Good, out today. Go on Amazon, take a look at it. Thanks
please,
so much for
thank
coming.
Thank you, So Good. Please help me beat the Ninja Turtles pizza book and jump on and buy a book, please.
Yeah, come on. And if you're going to buy a cartoon-based cookbook, make it be Bob's Burgers.
Agreed.
All right. Cooking issues.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.